In November 1978, the world recoiled in horror as news broke of over 900 Americans dead in a remote Guyanese jungle settlement. What began as a progressive church championing racial integration and social justice had transformed into one of history's most notorious cults. Raven by Tim Reiterman with John Jacobs remains the definitive account of Jim Jones and People's Temple, written by a journalist who survived being shot during the massacre. The book has become required reading in psychology, sociology, and religious studies programs worldwide, with figures like Oprah Winfrey citing it as essential to understanding how intelligent people can fall prey to manipulative leaders. Beyond its historical significance, Raven offers a chilling examination of how idealism can morph into fanaticism when power goes unchecked. Jones's childhood in Lynn, Indiana, revealed early signs of the complex personality that would later captivate thousands. Born into Depression-era poverty in 1931, he displayed both extraordinary compassion and disturbing cruelty from an early age. While he gathered food for homeless people and showed genuine concern for social outcasts, he simultaneously terrorized playmates with psychological manipulation and disturbing experiments. His mother Lynetta's religious fervor and his father James's absence due to illness significantly shaped his early worldview. Jones dominated neighborhood children through a sophisticated combination of fear and fascination. He required elaborate rituals and passwords like Hail Hitler to enter his loft, creating an exclusive atmosphere that made children desperate to belong. His macabre performances included staged animal resurrections and claims of supernatural powers. These theatrical displays often involved elaborate preparations, including hiding small animals and reviving them before amazed audiences. His scientific pursuits grew increasingly dark, progressing from collecting dead animals to drawing blood from living creatures and attempting crude cross-species transfusions, foreshadowing his later manipulation of followers through staged healings and medical fraud. Jones's religious journey began as an intense spiritual quest, taking him through every denomination in Lynn, Methodist, Baptist, Nazarene, and Pentecostal churches. He finally found his spiritual home at the Gospel Tabernacle, a Pentecostal church that welcomed society's marginalized members. This experience profoundly influenced his later ministry's focus on racial integration and social outcasts. Even as a teenager, he displayed remarkable theatrical instincts, walking through town in dramatic white robes while carrying an oversized Bible, often accompanied by a small group of devoted followers from among local children. Despite his eccentric behavior, Jones demonstrated exceptional intellectual capabilities. With an IQ reportedly above 140, he maintained excellent grades while pursuing his obsessive study of religious texts and historical figures. He particularly focused on charismatic leaders like Hitler, Stalin, and Father Divine, meticulously analyzing their methods of mass control, crowd psychology, and propaganda techniques. His personal library grew to include works on socialism, communism, and faith healing, which he would later incorporate into his unique blend of religious and political ideology. As he approached adulthood, Jones developed a sophisticated understanding of public perception. Recognizing that his extreme behaviors could limit his influence, he learned to moderate his public persona while maintaining his intense private beliefs. At 16, he began regularly hitchhiking to Richmond, where he established his first street ministry in predominantly black neighborhoods. His mature appearance, tall, dark-haired, and wearing a suit despite his youth, combined with his passionate delivery style, regularly drew crowds of 20 to 30 people, both black and white, marking his first success at crossing racial barriers. Jones's relationship with Marceline Baldwin, a nurse he met while working as an orderly, revealed crucial aspects of his personality. Their courtship and early marriage showed his ability to present a charming, idealistic facade while harboring darker impulses. Marceline's deep love and belief in their shared dream of creating an integrated family allowed her to rationalize his disturbing behaviors. Even in these early years, Jones displayed the controlling tendencies that would later define his leadership style, including training a monkey to attack their adopted son, Ronnie, on command, and subjecting the boy to psychological tests of loyalty. This pattern of alternating between charismatic charm and calculated cruelty would become his signature method of controlling followers throughout his career, laying the groundwork for the psychological manipulation that would eventually lead to tragedy. By 1956, Jones had discovered that religious people were particularly susceptible to manipulation. He organized a massive religious convention at Indianapolis's Cattle Tabernacle, sharing the pulpit with renowned healing evangelist William Branham. Both performed similar Pentecostal healing procedures, using personal details to build faith before healing people who would fall backward in religious ecstasy. Though Jones couldn't match Branham's success rate, the exposure proved invaluable for his growing ministry. At the convention, Jones met Archie Igems, a black former pastor who had become disillusioned with organized religion. Igems joined People's Temple after hearing Jones on radio, impressed by his message of racial brotherhood. Jones quickly made him associate pastor, helping attract black members while maintaining credibility with white fundamentalists. This strategic alliance exemplified Jones's skill at building a diverse congregation during America's segregation era. The temple expanded its social services with missionary zeal, opening a soup kitchen in 1960 that served 2,800 meals monthly, providing free clothing and helping the indigent. Jones demanded increasing commitment from members, encouraging them to view the temple as family and embrace religious communalism. These humanitarian efforts earned the temple legitimacy while creating dependency among its members, a crucial step in Jones's gradual takeover of their lives. Jones's theological limitations became increasingly apparent to his inner circle as he moved from traditional Christianity towards socialism. In a late 1961 sermon, he directly preached in favor of communism, prompting one member to stand in defense of free enterprise. Though Jones handled the objection with poise, the incident revealed his true political agenda behind the religious facade. To avoid division, Jones avoided using the term communism openly for years afterward, though his socialist beliefs remained central to his worldview. By 1964, Jones had so thoroughly conditioned his congregation through miraculous hoaxes and social evangelism that no conventional minister could have displaced him. Having deliberately split the church during his absence by appointing the divisive Russell Winberg as acting pastor, Jones had strategically placed loyalists like Archie Igems in key positions to maintain control. When Jones returned to Indianapolis, he struggled to recapture his former momentum, but his paranoia about nuclear Holocaust intensified, his self-adulation increased, and his attacks on the Bible grew more aggressive. Jones's manipulation of followers reached new heights as the temple expanded. He systematically dismantled traditional family bonds, replacing them with loyalty to himself and the cause. When Grace Stowen had a child, John Victor, Jones took extraordinary steps to bind the family to the church. He had Tim Stowen sign a paternity statement claiming Jones was the biological father, elevated Grace to the planning commission, and eventually separated the child from his parents for communal raising. The temple's disciplinary system evolved into a brutal spectacle of public punishment. Spankings with the Board of Education ranged from mild to severe beatings, with Jones orchestrating the proceedings like a master of ceremonies. Boxing matches pitted children as young as 5 against stronger opponents, later expanding to include adults in bloody confrontations. The message was clear: one cannot fight the collective will, father's will. Jones justified these psychodramas as preparation for society's rough conditions, but they primarily served to strengthen internal order and indoctrinate members. Jones weaponized sex to control and humiliate his followers, particularly targeting Tim Stowen by attacking his sexual identity. After securing Stowen's signature on a paternity document for John Victor, Jones tried forcing him to publicly admit homosexuality. From the pulpit, Jones spoke about sex with graphic candor that captivated his congregation. His body words and gestures provided vicarious thrills, while his rules controlled members' intimate lives through guilt, public cross-examinations, and informants. The temple security apparatus grew increasingly militaristic as Jones expanded into larger cities. By the mid-1970s, the temple had stockpiled nearly 200 guns, trained security squads, surrounded Jones with bodyguards, searched all service attendees, and provided armed escorts for temple buses. To maintain this siege mentality, Jones staged fake attacks, including a dramatic 1972 incident where he pretended to be shot and miraculously healed himself. This cultivation of external threats served to justify increasing isolation and control over members. The catharsis sessions dominated planning commission meetings, with almost no one immune from attack. Jones choreographed these confrontations, sometimes passing notes or pointing to indicate the next target. Members were forbidden to defend friends or loved ones, as this would undermine the concept of catharsis. These sessions created lasting divisions between friends, spouses, and lovers, further cementing Jones's absolute authority over personal relationships. By the late 1960s, San Francisco's political landscape had transformed, creating the perfect environment for People's Temple to flourish. Jim Jones cultivated powerful allies like Dr. Carlton B. Goodlett and Rev. Cecil Williams, though these relationships contained undercurrents of rivalry. Jones's greatest political coup came through Assemblyman Willie Brown, who connected the temple to George Moscone's 1975 mayoral campaign. The temple provided hundreds of disciplined volunteers who helped secure Moscone's narrow victory. Jones exaggerated the temple's membership and voting power to create the illusion of greater influence, claiming 8,000 San Francisco members when the actual numbers were far lower. After the election, Jones aggressively pursued political appointments, eventually securing a position on the Housing Authority Commission, where he became chairman and transformed dull meetings into spirited rallies. By 1976, Jones's self-proclaimed year of ascendancy, he had established favorable relationships with virtually all important public figures in San Francisco. The temple's relationship with the outside world was marked by paranoia, pragmatism, and concealment. Jones sought both secrecy and power, building a public image as a do-gooder church while cultivating political connections across the spectrum. In conservative Mendocino County, the temple infiltrated Republican circles, while in San Francisco, they aligned with liberal Democrats. Jones proved adept at wooing officials, calling in political debts, and playing the persecution card when needed. The pinnacle of Jones's year of ascendancy came with his September 1976 testimonial dinner. Though supposedly changed to a humanitarian benefit at Jones's insistence, it was clearly a tribute to him. Several hundred guests, including Lieutenant Governor DeMolle, Assemblyman Willie Brown, Mayor Moscone, and District Attorney Freitas, gathered at the transformed temple. The evening featured lavish praise from politicians and religious leaders. Republican Senator Milton Marks presented a state Senate resolution calling the temple an outstanding institution. Jones's political armor made it nearly impossible for critics or victims to challenge him. Even politicians disturbed by Jones's personality or methods remained silent, unwilling to risk opposing a church doing community work or offending a political organization with powerful friends. This political protection would delay serious investigations into temple abuses for years, allowing Jones to consolidate his control and eventually move his operation beyond American jurisdiction. Jones had been favorably impressed during his 1961 stopover in British Guyana. Its socialistic politics, English-speaking population, black governance, and small enough size that Jones could easily gain influence made it appealing. In October 1973, the Temple Board unanimously authorized establishing a branch church and agricultural mission there. The Guyanese government welcomed Americans settling near the disputed Venezuelan border, and Prime Minister Burnham's status would be enhanced by a predominantly black socialist American group choosing his country. The first temple settlers arrived to find Port Kaituma, a remote village with a tiny airstrip, a couple of rum shops, and roughly 50 simple houses built on stilts. Though not the tropical paradise Jones had promised, Mike Touchette embraced the pioneering spirit as they began clearing paths and preparing buildings. The Jonestown Pioneers established a permanent settlement in 1975 under Charlie and Joyce Touchette's leadership. Despite poor jungle soil requiring constant fertilization and substandard equipment from California, the settlers maintained productivity through Jones's recorded sermons reminding them of their mission. When Jones was absent, the settlers lived autonomously and happily. Their days began at sunrise, working until 5:30 p.m. with breaks for meals. Evenings were free except Sundays, with activities including movies, reading, and card games. Mike Touchette particularly enjoyed quiet evenings on the porch, listening to jungle sounds with friends after turning off the generator. This relative freedom would disappear once Jones relocated permanently to Jonestown. By 1977, the temple meticulously organized its mass migration to Guyana, ensuring all members' personal affairs were put in order. Each traveler followed detailed checklists covering address changes, pet disposal, car title transfers, bill payments, and rerouting of government payments. Members signed medical releases, provided health histories, and gave the church power of attorney over their children, effectively surrendering control of their personal affairs to the temple. Despite the litany of allegations back home, Jonestown initially impressed visitors with its physical transformation. Nearly 1,000 people had converted 300 acres of dense jungle into a neatly organized settlement. The compound featured a guarded entrance, agricultural fields, communal facilities, dormitories, and cottages, all connected by boardwalks showing the pride that went into construction. For many seniors, particularly Southern blacks who had fled urban ghettos, Jonestown provided security despite the hardships. By late 1977, white nights had become routine, occurring twice monthly. Jones's paranoia intensified when a temple member named Debbie Blakey defected in May 1978. Her departure triggered another white night on Jones's 47th birthday. In the radio room, Jones asked Dr. Schacht how everyone could commit suicide. Schacht suggested sedating everyone and giving heart injections, while Jones added they could shoot everyone. Stefan and Marceline opposed such talk, with Stefan challenging, "Do you really think you can take the lives of 1,000 people? It's not that easy." Jones insisted Blakey's defection endangered them all. "It's better for us all to die together, proud, than have them discredit us and take us apart and make us look like a bunch of crazy people." When Stefan pointed out that mass suicide would itself look crazy, Jones replied, "Well, at first, maybe they'll think we're crazy, but it's going to go down in history as a great act." By October 1978, Jones had created a prison-like environment in Jonestown, warning that both Guyanese authorities and temple guards would shoot escapees. He lied that the Guyana Tax Board and U.S. Embassy would notify him of any attempted defections and graphically described the horrors of drinking gasoline to deter suicide attempts. As morale plummeted, Jones tried manipulating his followers with threats about U.S. concentration camps while promising Soviet relocation. Jones increasingly used the Extended Care Unit, ECU, to control dissenters through heavy drugging. Vincent Lopez, Shonda James, Barbara Walker, attorney Gene Chaikin, and Charlie Touchette were among those drugged into submission. When 19-year-old Shonda James, who had become Jones's lover, expressed interest in another man, she was immediately sent to ECU and drugged into a zombie-like state. Jones's lifestyle contradicted the community's supposed egalitarianism. He lived in West House, the best structure in Jonestown, with his mistresses Carolyn Layton and Maria Katsaris. His bedroom contained a large four-poster bed, refrigerator stocked with special foods and liquor shipped from San Francisco, and cabinets filled with drugs, hair dye, and oxygen equipment for his attacks. Meanwhile, most residents subsisted on rice and gravy while working exhausting hours in tropical heat. Jones increasingly used the Extended Care Unit, ECU, to control dissenters through heavy drugging. Vincent Lopez, Shonda James, Barbara Walker, attorney Gene Chaykin, and Charlie Touchette were among those drugged into submission. When 19-year-old Shonda James, who had become Jones's lover, expressed interest in another man, she was immediately sent to ECU and drugged into a zombie-like state. Jones's lifestyle contradicted the community's supposed egalitarianism. He lived in West House, the best structure in Jonestown, with his mistresses Carolyn Layton and Maria Katsaris. His bedroom contained a large four-poster bed, refrigerator stocked with special foods and liquor shipped from San Francisco, and cabinets filled with drugs, hair dye, and oxygen equipment for his attacks. Meanwhile, most residents subsisted on rice and gravy while working exhausting hours in tropical heat. Back in the United States, Congressman Leo Ryan's interest in Jonestown began through a deeply personal connection when he visited Sammy Houston, who was recovering from throat cancer surgery. Their meeting was particularly poignant, as Ryan had roomed with Sam nearly 20 years earlier during Kennedy's inauguration, creating a bond that would ultimately draw Ryan into the People's Temple story. Over the following months, Ryan's interest intensified as he methodically gathered evidence about the settlement, learning disturbing details about the custody battle over John Stowen, Debbie Blakey's dramatic defection, and the increasingly vocal concerns of the Concerned Relatives organization. The turning point came when Claire Bouquet, a desperate schoolteacher, visited his office seeking help locating her son, Brian. Ryan's response was immediate and resolute, "I'll go down there." As Ryan's visit approached, Jones's already fragile mental state deteriorated into acute paranoia. He implemented increasingly restrictive measures, regularly warning residents about fabricated jungle dangers, from deadly snakes to armed mercenaries, to discourage escape attempts. His rhetoric became more extreme, claiming Ryan might launch a covert amphibious assault at night with 40 armed men and issuing stark warnings that any unauthorized visitors would leave it dead. Despite the atmosphere of fear, several families had begun carefully orchestrating escape plans. The Parks family had methodically hidden supplies and belongings near the piggery over several weeks, while the Boak family strengthened their resolve through secret conversations while working in the agricultural fields. 18-year-old Monica Bagby, who had detested Jonestown since her forced arrival, meticulously planned her departure, carefully observing guard patterns and jungle paths. When Ryan and his entourage finally arrived at Jonestown on November 17, 1978, they encountered a settlement that bore all the hallmarks of careful staging. Residents had been strategically positioned along predetermined routes, creating an artificial appearance of normalcy. The visitors were treated to rehearsed performances, including children singing and residents working contentedly in their assigned roles. However, as the inspection continued, cracks in the facade began to appear. When defectors started coming forward, Jim Jones's composure visibly crumbled. His face grew increasingly ashen as he watched longtime loyalists like the Parks and Bogue families reject his pleas to stay. Ryan, seeing his suspicions confirmed, noted that people were coming out of the woodwork, forcing hasty arrangements for additional transportation. The situation reached a breaking point when Bonnie Simon erupted in a violent confrontation with her husband over the custody of their children, her threats echoing through the settlement. As 16 defectors loaded onto the truck, a symbolic moment occurred when Maria Katsaris threw her silver cross to a reporter, delivering a final message for her brother, "Tell Steve I don't believe in God." The tension culminated in a shocking assault when Don Sly, a longtime Temple member, attacked Congressman Ryan from behind, pressing a knife to his throat while snarling, "Congressman Ryan, you motherfucker." Though Ryan escaped the attempt on his life during the chaotic struggle that followed, this violent outburst served as a chilling preview of the devastating events that would soon unfold. As the defectors and journalists attempted to leave from the Port Kaituma airstrip on November 18, 1978, Temple security guards opened fire, killing Congressman Ryan, three journalists, and one defector, while wounding several others. Back at Jonestown, Jones gathered his followers at the pavilion and announced that all was lost. In a final address captured on tape, he convinced or coerced over 900 followers to drink cyanide-laced Flavor-Aid, creating one of history's most horrific mass murder suicides. The Guyanese army discovered 913 temple members dead at Jonestown. Besides Jim Jones and Annie Moore, both with bullet wounds to the head, the dead included John Stowen, Chemo Prokes, Marceline Jones, Carolyn Layton, Maria Katsaris, and hundreds of others who had followed Jones to Guyana seeking a better life. Most who escaped were white defectors who left with Ryan, while those who fled independently before or during the suicide ritual were predominantly black. The world rejected Jones's attempt to frame the mass death as revolutionary suicide, instead viewing it as madness and cruelty. In the aftermath, fear of Temple hit squads spread, though these never materialized. Temple loyalists in San Francisco destroyed documents and surrendered weapons, while grieving relatives gathered outside the temple demanding answers. Politicians who had supported Jones scrambled to distance themselves. The surviving temple members faced devastating loss, not just of loved ones, but of their entire identity, community, and purpose. Some eventually rebuilt their lives, while others struggled with depression and survivor's guilt. Former press aide Michael Prokes committed suicide months later during a press conference, claiming he had originally joined the temple as a government agent, but leaving no evidence to support this claim. Despite government failures, the ultimate blame rests with Jim Jones himself, whose paranoia, megalomania, and destructive personality brought down the temple. Evidence suggests Jones may have planned to escape while his followers died, possibly using the untouched Cessna at Port Kaituma with Michael Prokes, a licensed pilot, and the Carter brothers. Whether Jones aborted this plan or someone else ensured he wouldn't survive remains one of Jonestown's enduring mysteries. Who shot Jim Jones? The Jonestown tragedy offers a haunting reminder of how charismatic leadership can transform idealism into fanaticism. What began as a progressive movement championing racial integration and social justice ended in mass death in a remote jungle. The story of People's Temple continues to resonate because it exposes the vulnerability of human psychology to manipulation, the dangers of unquestioning loyalty, and how easily noble intentions can be perverted by a leader's unchecked power and deteriorating mental state. In our age of polarization and extremism, the lessons of Jonestown remain disturbingly relevant.